This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Biagio Pagano and Craig Voland will join host Craig Lubo to discuss moving toward sustainable agriculture in the United States. Topics will include how food is produced globally, the impact of agriculture on the environment, advantages and disadvantages of synthetic pesticides, alternatives to conventional pesticides, GMOs, and sustainable concepts. But first, I'm Naturally with your headline news. FuelFix.com reports, the Obama administration moved on several fronts Friday to block new oil drilling in the Arctic Ocean, weeks after Shell said it would be walking away from the area for the foreseeable future. The Interior Department announced it was canceling government auctions of drilling rights in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas, previously scheduled for 2016 and 2017, respectively. At the same time, it formally rejected bids to Statoil and Shell for more time to search for crude under their existing Arctic leases. EcoWatch.com reports, the city of Oslo has today become the first capital city in the world to ban investments in fossil fuels as it announced it will divest from its $9 billion pension fund from coal, oil, and gas companies. Today's announcement follows a previous pledge in March to ban investment in coal. Environmental activist and 350.org co-founder Bill McKibben was arrested on Thursday after staging a protest at a gas station in Burlington, Vermont, to bring attention to ExxonMobil's decades-long efforts to undermine climate action for the corporation's own gain, further explained by CommonDreams.org. It's no secret that the fossil fuel industry, the set of companies and corporate interests which profit most from the burning of coal, oil, and gas, have been the largest purveyors and funders of climate change denialism in the world. Now, a new set of documents and a report released by the Union of Concerned Scientists, or UCS, answers the age-old question always asked when it comes to crimes of corruption, cover-up, and moral defiance. What did they know, and when did they know it? As it turns out, the climate deceptions dossiers shows that leading oil giants such as ExxonMobil, BP, and Shell, just like tobacco companies who buried and denied the threat of cancer for smokers, knew about the dangers of global warming and the role of carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions long before the public received warning from the broader scientific community. And what's worse is not only that they knew, but how they spent the last nearly 30 years actively denying the damage they were causing to the planet and its inhabitants. ColumbianMissourian.com reports, the inaugural People's Climate Float, organized by the Missouri Coalition for the Environment, Sierra Club, and several other groups, carried petitions downriver from Cooper's Landing, south of Columbia, for delivery in Jefferson City to Governor Jay Nixon and State Attorney Chris Koster. The petition seeks support for more wind and solar energy, a reduction in carbon emissions into the atmosphere, and other action on climate change. The event was part of the People's Climate Movement's National Day of Action, designed to mobilize citizens and place pressure on politicians to confront climate change. More than 150 communities hosted events Wednesday that were documented on Twitter with the hashtag People's Climate. 10 floaters left Cooper's Landing on Wednesday morning in 4 canoes, 1 kayak, and 1 paddleboard. The Missouri Clean Energy Coalition, an umbrella organization, said it includes groups and officials that represent 100,000 Missourians. The Kansas City region is one of 27 communities across the nation selected to join the STEM, or Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, STEM Ecosystems Initiative, according to an announcement by the White House. Known as Ecosystem KC, the local effort will be led by KC STEM Alliance in partnership with Science Pioneers, the Mid-America Regional Council, and the Kansas Enrichment Network. Building on more than a decade of research into successful STEM collaborations, the STEM Funders Network and 350 committed local funders and organizations are announcing a 5-year effort to create 100 tight-knit local STEM networks, STEM ecosystems, that bring together broad-scale cross-sector collaborations to nurture and scale effective science, technology, engineering, and math. learning opportunities for all young people, especially girls and underserved populations. Kansas City was selected to participate in the initiative in recognition of the strong STEM community developed here and a demonstrated commitment to continue this work. That's all for the news today. Mike, do you want to introduce our guests? Or
why don't we let Craig do that? And welcome to Eco Radio KC here on 90.1 FM.
Okay, thank you, Mike. My guest today, as Aaron said, is Craig Volland and Biagio Pagano. And Craig Volland is a qualified environmental professional and serves as the chair of the Agricultural Committee of the Kansas chapter of the Sierra Club. And Biagio Pagano is currently, he's an adjunct professor at three area universities, Baker University, Park University, Kansas City Art Institute. He teaches environmental sciences and some health classes at those universities. Previously, he worked as in public health and environment for various state and city agencies, departments, including the most recent, I think, was when you were at Wyandotte Unified Government Public Health Department. Okay, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And so we're going to be talking about, of course, agriculture issues, as naturally indicated. And the first thing we want to get into is to have both of you chime in on this. What is sustainable agriculture?
The term itself, the key term in that is actually sustainable, because when we're talking about something that is sustainable, whether it's agriculture, sustainable development, whatever it might be, sustainable use of products, and making sure that we're protecting our environment in the production of something like this. So anyway, when we're talking about sustainable agriculture, it's the production of food, fiber, and other plant and animal products. They use farming techniques that protect the environment, public health, human communities, and animal welfare. The sustainable issue is interwoven within that, or sustainable term is interwoven within that definition.
Okay. And can you tell us maybe the little bit from the opposite viewpoint, what would make different agricultural practices unsustainable? What would be some examples of that?
Well, our whole system for producing meat is utterly unsustainable because it creates such a vast amount of waste that is not properly recycled. A lot of it ends up in the water or in the air. Most people don't realize how much air pollution comes. This is regional or even national air pollution comes from these big animal factories, many of which we have in Missouri and Kansas. Other things is residues from wide-scale use of pesticides, and probably the most important is soil erosion, because that really takes eons to be created, and we are using intensive methods that cause excess soil erosion that goes into our streams and eventually into the Gulf of Mexico primarily.
I'd like to dovetail on what Craig was saying about the meat production process. The meat production between 1950 and 2010 increased more than sixfold throughout the entire world. That's an amazing amount of resources that are used in terms of energy, topsoil, pesticides to grow the grains and things like that. In China, if you look at that country alone, between 1978 and the year 2012, there has been a ninefold increase in meat production because of very high population growth that's growing exponentially, as it is worldwide. And animal agriculture uses more than half of the water that's used here in the United States. Most of it is to grow the grains and to wash away manure, things like that. And when you look at topsoil loss, erosion, which Craig mentioned, 85% of our topsoil is lost due to animal agriculture. And that's not counting all of the tropical forest destruction, especially in the Amazon basin, to grow the grains. The U.S. Livestock industry produces, or livestock in general, produces 21 times more excrement than the human population in the U.S. So it's significant.
All right. And how is food produced in general globally?
Okay. It's produced on various ways. Croplands produce about 77% of the world's food, and that is on 11% of the landmass of planet Earth, and 16% of the world food is produced on rangelands, feedlots, and pastures, and that's 29% of the world's land, on 29% of the world's land. So that alone is 40% of the landmass of planet Earth to feed one species, us as humans. And the other 7% of the world's food is produced in aquaculture and in fisheries, things like that. I think it's important to also note that 66% of the world's population consumes three major grains, and that's wheat, corn, and rice, and that provides roughly about half of the global calories. And the rest, of course, is meat and seafood and things like that. And biologists and botanists have identified a minimum of 50,000 different types of plants that are edible for human populations. So why am I mentioning that? It's because reliance on such a small handful of foods violates the principle of biodiversity. When you have such small amounts of foods feeding large populations, if things catastrophically happen, such as shifts in climate change, land degradation, anything like that, different types of diseases that crops can be affected by, it can be quite catastrophic in specific regions and even worldwide. And we have two major forms of the way that food is being grown or provided, and that's industrialized farming, which is a very high input monocultures, and you also have traditional forms of growing food, which is low input polyculture, which does not violate the principles of biodiversity.
You list three types of grains that are the most common that we seem to rely on.
Correct.
Wheat and rice and corn.
And
I know a few other grains, oats.
Soy.
Okay.
Soybeans, yeah.
Barley, oats, yeah.
So if we change that so that we're using kind of equal amounts of all of those grains, does that change the impact on the environment?
It can change it from the perspective of allowing more of the variety that is out there. And the greater the variety, the less chance that horrible changes could occur within the food system, because you're expanding the amount of grains and different types of foods, especially plant-based foods that could be available for populations. And that's not counting the energy. I mean, my goodness, the energy that is required. Industrial agriculture uses about 20% of the commercial energy in the United States. And food travels an average of about 1,300 miles from farm to plate. And for every 10 units of non-renewable fossil fuel energy, that provides one unit of nutrients or food energy on the table. So you can see it's a very unusual ratio there. It takes a lot of energy to produce the food that we need.
All right. And you also talked about the different systems for production. And I'd like you to elaborate on two of those systems and kind of tell us what the difference is. And that would be the difference between croplands and rangelands.
Rangelands tend to be a little bit more favorable because they're in open spaces, and a lot of times there's a symbiotic relationship between the animals that are raised in those areas in rangelands compared to croplands. And the croplands, it really depends on how the food is grown, because if it's through factory farming, it's unsustainable. If we're using polyculture, and you have a variety of different plants, you have more biodiversity and less of a chance that these foods or these crops would spoil or not be available for populations. And you would have less reliance on pesticides and things like that. And of course, we're going to get into more detail about the use of chemicals in growing food and alternatives to that as well.
All right. Let's move a little bit into the chemicals. What are the advantages of synthetic pesticides, and what are the disadvantages?
Well, the advantage to some pesticides is that in certain circumstances they can bring greater yields when there's heavy pest pressure. But actually, most studies have shown that farming properly without pesticides gives you just about as much of a yield. There's been a number of studies in the last 20 years that organic agriculture does a really good job of yielding quite a bit of food without the high loss of soil, for example, because a healthy soil is the most important feature of organic agriculture. So it absorbs and holds water so much better. And the nature of it is such that even if you have heavy rains, it goes into the soil rather than running off and taking particles. So there would be circumstances where chemicals would give you a higher yield, but I think it is really not true in my view, observing it in the last 30 years, that it is really superior. And of course, there's some real downsides to chemicals. If they're not properly applied, they can get out and kill lots of other life. And there's a risk to human health particularly to workers. I think the greatest risk is to farm workers. But also there's residues on food, and it's been found in the blood of children. They've done a number of studies to show that it gets into the young children bodies. So you can tell I'm not a big fan of farm chemicals.
Let me ask you this. When you talk about the health impacts of some of the pesticides and getting into the children, are there natural pesticides that are safer than the synthetic ones?
Well, there is one. It's called the BT toxin, which has been used in organic agriculture for 30 or 40 years. It's actually comes from a soil organism. It's very common, and it's almost everywhere. And so they learn to isolate it and produce it in cultures. And so it's sprayed on some organic crops, although not widely. It's usually the whole organic principle is to not intervene in nature unless it's absolutely necessary. So there's other types of things, like crop rotation is probably the most important way that pests are kept in check. Most people don't realize if you switch most pests only eat one type of crop. And so if you're keeping them off balance by moving your crop around, they come up, the pest will wake up in the spring and go for the corn, but meanwhile you've put in oats or something and there's nothing to eat. So that's the way it's been done for a long time and is still very effective. But there are a few instances where they'll use the BT toxin as one, or beneficial insects that prey on your bad guys.
And these are the biological controls that many organic farmers use in this country as well as other nations. Spiders, ladybugs, parasitic wasps.
Right.
In Nigeria, for example, when you see planes that are above these agricultural crops, agricultural areas, and you see them spraying, they're actually not spraying chemicals. They're spraying wasps, parasitic wasps, and they time it in such a way so that as the crops are growing, the insect pests are going to be there, but so will the control mechanism that they use entomologically. Also in China, they use what's called a banana spider. A banana spider is has gained a lot of notoriety within that country because it does a great job in reducing insect pest infestation. And once again, it's timed in such a way so that when the pests are there, so are the control mechanisms. The cost of pesticides is unimaginable. First of all, you got to remember that only 0.1% or less than 0.1% of all the pesticides reach their target population, the target insect pests. That means that there's more than 99.9% of these pesticides that contaminate the soil, the water, and they do become airborne. They can volatilize. People can breathe them in, or it can move into other areas where people are growing things organically. And one organization, the International Food Policy Research Institute, mentions that the cost is somewhere between $100 to $200 billion a year, in damages, or 5 to 10%, or $5 to $10 in damage for every dollar that is spent on in synthetic pesticides.
Yeah, and
folks,
that,
we're going to take a break real quick. This will be our first break, but I do want to let folks know that they can join in if they have any questions. The number to call is 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-KKFI. We'll be right back with Eco Radio KC after these messages.
Support for KKFI comes from Harris Casino, presenting Mistress of Reality live at the Voodoo Lounge, Saturday, October 31st, Halloween night. Featuring Izzy Osborne, Nancy Iommi, Jill Ward, and Sheezer Butler, Mistress of Reality is an all-female tribute to the godfathers of metal, Black Sabbath. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster.com. That's Mistress of Reality, live at the Voodoo Lounge, Saturday, October 31st, Halloween night.
Join us on the next edition of Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m., when we will continue the conversation about homelessness in Kansas City. Our guest will include Kathy Dean, Director of Project Uplift, with co-hosts Brian Noland and Craig Lubo.
The Beehive Design Collective uses drawing to see the struggle for environmental justice in Latin America. Find out all about this traveling mural, designed and drawn by the collective, on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
Balancing water and energy needs on this CurrentCast. Vast amounts of energy are used to treat and transport water. At the same time, water is integral to the production of energy.
They are inextricably linked, and without one, we cannot have the other.
That's Regina Buono of Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. She says planters in water or energy must therefore consider the other sector as a limiting factor when developing new plants and distribution lines, especially given limited resources and new regulations. Buono therefore believes interdisciplinary communication is key. She says if each sector grasps the other's scientific and policy complexities, it will lead to better budgeting, increased efficiencies, and better long-term planning. Support for CurrentCast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Okay, welcome back. And for those of you just joining us, we are talking about the impact of agriculture on environmental issues. And our guest is Craig Volland and Biagio Pagano. Biagio, you were talking a little bit about parasitic wasp and the banana spider and some of those to control other pests instead of the synthetic pesticides. And I can imagine a lot of people, like myself, are thinking, you're kind of scaring us with the idea of using wasp and stuff. Some of us are, like me, I'm terrified of those insects. So,
well, it's a good point, and a lot of people are also terrified about pesticides, too, and they cause much more damage. I think that's a good point. But, it's all controlled. And also, too, when the wasps have done their job, they actually provide a food source for other animals, birds, for example. So it's looking at growing food, as an ecosystem, and using really the natural controls in nature has been using for quite a long time. The other thing is using like insect pheromones. I know this sounds kind of strange, but even insects have sex attractant kinds of compounds that they excrete. And some of these farmers use that. And what they do is these are synthesized, and they're used to lure insect pests into different types of traps, and it keeps them away from the crops. You know, and it's not 100% effective, but it does minimize the damage. The other thing, too, is that certain types of pheromones actually attract insect predators, which could feed on the insect pests, and that's and there's no chemical residue, obviously, on something like that. Farmers are always concerned about controlling weeds, and instead of using like weed control measures that are chemically based, you can use cover crops, and there's mulches that you can use to keep that down at a good level and make it beneficial for crop production.
And what are some of the biological controls? Would that be what you would talk about with pest control?
Yeah, and there's, you know, and certain types of insect predators favor certain types of insect pests, so they have to be evaluated, you know, through the concept called integrated pest management, which they use pretty successfully, for example, in Indonesia, where plants, where crops and pests are evaluated as part of an entire ecosystem. And it uses a combination of cultivation methods, biological controls, and chemical tools. Chemicalization only is a last result, and they would use that from plant-based compounds rather than something that would be synthesized. And to bring the pest population down, and you can still grow food at an economically acceptable level, so that it doesn't affect the economics of the region or the country.
And Craig, before you were talking about the chemicals, the natural
right.
chemical, you mentioned BT toxin.
Right.
Are there other natural chemicals too that are ever used? Or
not that I'm aware of. I may be wrong, but I just don't. That's the main one that's used. There probably are a few. They just don't rely on spraying in organic agriculture very much. So, I did want to comment that Biagio said that it was, I think, the damages from the use of chemicals is $5 for every dollar of the cost of the chemicals. This is called by the economists an external cost, which means that even if it looks like that this food we're getting from industrial agriculture is cheap, it's really not so cheap. If you had to add in that $5 instead of the $1 direct cost of chemicals, then the price of these industrial foods would be quite a bit higher. And so, therefore, organic agriculture is really held up to an unfair standard in that regard, because a much greater percentage of the true cost is reflected in the cost of organic agriculture.
All right. And Biagio, I had you explain a little bit between the difference between the rangeland and the cropland before. I want to go back to that for a second. Between various different types of production, are some of those types more environmentally friendly than other types?
It all depends on the management. You know, any kind of ecological terrestrial ecosystem could be managed properly. And it all depends on the methods that are used, as opposed to maybe looking at the advantages or disadvantages of the nutrient levels within these systems, within these locations. So it's the way that we are growing the food as opposed to the actual and botanical differences in soil fertility and things like that between these ecosystems.
All right. And we also discussed, and I'd like both of you to expand more on the percentage, the amount of water that's used in agriculture. And if you can expand a little bit more on the impact of that, and what can we do in terms of the methods of agriculture to reduce the amount of water that's used?
Well, what I've noticed the most, especially in dealing with some of our local farmers who are organic, is that because organic agriculture focuses so much on getting more organic material into the soil and opening it up so that it absorbs what moisture you get, that actually when it's dry, almost drought conditions are almost favorable to organic agriculture because all the rain that falls stays in the soil longer. And many of our farmers do actually better when it's dry than when it's really wet, like we had this last spring, because organic soil is really an ecosystem. It's you want these creatures to be in there doing their job. They break down the nutrients for the plants so they can be taken up by the roots. You don't want to put synthetic nitrogen or urea or whatever into it that kills these little animals. You want a healthy ecosystem in your soil. And if there's one thing that organic or agriculture does, it's create the very best soil. And that gives you a lot of resilience in your need for water and with regard to the weather systems.
And these organic compounds that Craig is talking about is like the compost and manure from animals and all that, as opposed to toxic human sewage sludge, things like that. Those things have to be taken into consideration. When you overuse, and if it's not properly done, we haven't talked enough about the fertilizers. We're talking a lot about pesticides, but when you look at the amount of commercial fertilizers that are used, when it does rain, it gets connected to the hydrologic cycle. These compounds get into waterways. It gets into estuaries, like they did in the eastern area. It gets into rivers, lakes, and streams. It gets into the oceans, and it causes the massive algae blooms. And the algae blooms, when they get into the top areas of the water, what it does is it inhibits photosynthesis. So your benthic plants at the very bottom of the waterways that produce oxygen for marine organisms to survive is compromised because you're not allowing as much of the sunlight to penetrate through. So then when these plants die, you have decomposer bacteria that continue to use up the existing oxygen in the water, and that reduces oxygen levels even more. So what you have, in essence, is a synergistic effect of the lack of photosynthesis or diminishment of that, and the use of the massive use of oxygen of these microorganisms that break down dead material because they feed on that.
And as far as those fertilizers, what are natural ways of fertilizing instead of using the chemical fertilizers?
Well, you've got nitrogen-rich chemicals, natural chemicals within compost. You have it in manure, and you have a variety of different nutrients that are not only more, but there's a greater abundance when you're using natural systems like that. And then they're not compromised with by the chemicals, and so it always works a lot better.
Well, there's a nitrogen fixing plants. You see, most organic farmers will rotate their fields so that they plant things like clover or alfalfa, or there's a couple of others that actually take nitrogen right out of the air, and so that's really probably the single greatest source of nitrogen into the soil for organic systems.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the conventional systems do the same thing, but it's very much the case that that's where they get a lot of that. And then they can plow that material in at the end of the particular season. They plow that in, and that becomes organic material in the soil that absorbs water.
And when you use that, there's less of a chance that will be there's less runoff of natural nitrogen-rich compounds that can get
right
into the water. So that's easily controlled. And once again, we're mimicking the processes of the botanical functions of nature.
And I assume that one of the additional side effects of what we're putting in the runoff into the water is the cost factor of what it costs to get that back out of the water.
That's a good point, because one of the pesticides that is still widely used all over the Midwest is atrazine. Atrazine happens to be very soluble, water soluble, and so it gets into our water supply, and there's a direct cost of taking it back out. And most of the large cities have what they call activated carbon filters because it's adsorbed by carbon. So that's a direct cost of using atrazine that is not reflected in the price of the products that are grown using that pesticide.
And you think about what's happened with the Chesapeake Bay because of all these massive amounts of algae blooms due to nitrogen-rich synthetic fertilizers. It's caused massive fish kills, and it's affected the fishing industry there, the tourism industry, because of oxygen deprivation. It wasn't something that happened overnight. This was something that happened over many years. And up to this day, they're still suffering. And if you had to, I always tell my students, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth more than a ton of cure. By preventing these things from the very beginning, you will save so much more of the cost later on if you had to come back and do the remediation or the treatment or something like that. It's a lose-lose situation in every way.
And that cost, as far as I know, is borne mostly by the taxpayer, not by the polluters.
Well, it's borne by the commons is what the economic term is. It's borne by everybody else but who's buying the product. And so that could be the wildlife, too. And mm-hmm. they really absorb a high cost of these methods.
And, Biagio, you mentioned that about the animal manure is one of the ways of fertilizing.
Correct.
But doesn't that also produce more methane, and how do you balance that?
Well, of course, the animal manure, being a rich nutrient, a natural nutrient, has to be processed first. So you want to take care of any potential bacterial infection. And yes, it does produce methane, but, you know, for doing everything right, you know, in this world and cutting down on livestock facilities, reducing our meat consumption, you know, then you have a balancing factor and you'll have less of the methane emissions. So it's not just segregated only to the animal manure, but everything else that we actually do.
I want to remind the listeners, if you have any questions, you can give us a call. The number in the studio is 816-931-5534, and we are talking about agriculture issues with Craig Vollen and Biagio Pagano.
May I make a point here, since I live in Kansas, Craig Vollen lives in Kansas, and so do you. When I was working with the health department, we noticed that there were some wells and some groundwater in the western part of Kansas that was affected by nitrate contamination, which comes directly from our use of inorganic commercial fertilizers. It's a real detriment, especially to very young children and to infants, infants that are 6 months and younger, because if they ingest well water, which comes from the manure, it can come from the fertilizers. When that's ingested, it's converted into nitrites. The nitrates are converted to nitrites, and that interferes with the absorption of oxygen, you know, within the infant population. And it can be fatal, but there are treatment methods, you know, to deal with that. But that's something we have to consider as well.
All right. We do have a caller on the line. Caller, would you state your name and where you're calling from?
And you are on the air, caller.
Independence.
You're on the air, caller.
Right. Yeah, as I said, Jack from Independence.
Okay.
And what's your question?
I think it's very good to hear the things that your guests are talking about. However, most of us, I can't say most of us, but many of us agree that we've been poisoned. But we have big mega companies, I'll say Monsanto, but there are others, that have had like a 30, 40-year head start. They got their wealth. They got the control. They pretty much destroyed organic in just the requirements for labeling, but yet they can't even be held accountable for labeling GMO. How does the everyday person take on a Monsanto?
Well, I'm well aware of this labeling issue of GMOs. It's in Congress right now, and it's a hot issue. But the fallback there is if if we lose that issue and GMOs continue to be unlabeled, you cannot use genetically engineered crops in organic agriculture, so that if you have food that's certified organic, then you know pretty much that it is does not contain GMOs. So no matter
I'm
what
aware
happens.
Their stuff blows over on the corn crop and suddenly you stole their crop rather than they destroyed the organic. Not to mention the water they're using up. But anyway, I appreciate you guys' insight, but you're not doing anything for the common man. God bless.
All right. Thanks for your call, caller. We can respond to that after we take our second break right here. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 816-931-5534.
Supporting 90.1 FM, Mixed Master Recording, for your next voiceover project, demo, or full album. Pro Tools certified and eager to bring out the full potential of your music. Mixnaster's passion is in the music, keeping the creative process in the hands of the composer. Information and scheduling at mixnaster.com. That's MIXNASTER.com.
KKFI would like to thank those who pledged during our recent fund drive. If you haven't sent in your contribution yet, please take the time to send it in the envelope provided. Thank you so much. We couldn't do it without you.
Okay, welcome back, and we are talking about agriculture issues. And Biagio, would you like to respond to that last call?
I can sense the frustration that this gentleman had regarding, maybe what we're saying is not good for the common man, but we haven't finished our interview yet, so there's some other points I'd like to bring into our discussion that I think would be helpful and things that we could all do, you know, individually to make a difference and keep our family healthy when it comes to nutrition, okay? Some of the things, support your local organic farmers and, buy organic. You know, that is something that is good for the common man, you know, and by doing that, the more money we put into those kinds of organically produced foods, the greater the market, and that will infiltrate and help more people. The other thing, too, is that this caller could also contact the Kansas City Food Circle. And you can just get on the website and just type in your search field, Kansas City Food Circle, and it puts the buyer and the consumer together, you know, that would help families, businesses, restaurants, things like that.
Let me interject real quickly. When you do that, when you patronize the local organic and free-range farmers like that, you're basically cutting out the middleman so that the price of these of the food you can buy from these farmers is really not much, if anything, above what you get in a grocery store. So whereas it is true that organic food in a grocery store tends to be more expensive, that isn't always the case when you're dealing directly with the local farmers.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The other thing, the other comment I want to make is eat low in the food chain. Eat more fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, things like that. You can get a lot of your proteins from eating legumes like beans, lentils, fava beans, things like that. Since I do teach a course in nutrition, there are some amazing benefits that you can get from that, reducing the risk of obesity, the risk of type 2 diabetes, various types of heart disease, things like that, various types of cancers, and, eating kind of like pollution-free, you know, will be good for, as you mentioned, the common man. So there's a lot of things, you know, that can be done. And you could also grow your own. If you're ambitious enough, you have the time, you know, then you have control over what you are growing, as they do in many European countries, you know. And I'm from Italy myself, and you have a lot of small communities and people within these areas, you know, that grow a lot of their own because it's just part of their culture. And they do eat healthier, and their health status actually shows that as well. You could also cut food waste and compost whatever you can. The amount of food that's wasted in the United States alone is unbelievable, as much of a third, and some researchers put that as much as 40% of the food supply during the production process and consumption is wasted. And that comes out on average about 20 pounds of food per person per month. So there's a lot that we can do, and if we do that, that will also secure our, more of our economy.
Yeah, I'd like to just add, the caller had a good point about the power of Monsanto and the Cargills and the, what I would call Big Ag. I've been working on this issue for 30 years, and it's they pretty much have a lock on our political system. And so we have to change the way we vote.
Agree.
And you vote when you buy your food from a local farmer instead of in the grocery store. You vote when you no longer buy sugar and fat-filled processed foods, and rather you do more cooking at home with fresh ingredients, especially good vegetables and fruits. That's how you essentially outvote the Monsantos and the Cargills.
Do those companies have the same power in Europe as they do in the United States and Canada?
Not that I'm aware of. Although I will say that in Europe, it's a much of the there's many more smaller farmers in Europe, but they do they're highly subsidized, but they have more of a sense of the common good in Europe, is my experience, and having been over there many times, so that. They have what they call a precautionary principle in agricultural issues, which is that anybody like Monsanto that comes over there has to overcome a much greater level of skepticism about all these high-tech foods they want to sell. So there's most people in Europe, for example, don't want GMOs. They don't trust that stuff for good reason. And so they have, I think, a much healthier food system over there.
All right.
Would you mind if I mention something about seafood? Because we're talking about eating low in the food chain. And
sure.
Of course, seafood is always a great substitute, but there's some pros and cons to that as well. But there is an organization called the Marine Stewardship Council. And what they do is they certify the seafood that is caught in sustainable ways because there are some species of fish that are certainly threatened, and we want to be careful about that. And fish has an advantage that meat doesn't have. You know, for example, you have a better source of a healthier fat, like omega-3 is really good, and zinc and other compounds. The some of the fish that is recommended as to avoid would be things like Atlantic cod, excuse me, Atlantic halibut, Chilean sea bass, grouper, monkfish, orange roughy, redfish, shark, rays, swordfish, marlin, and bluefin tuna are sort of like suggested not to really to stay away from. Some of the healthier stocks that people may want to delve into as a good source of protein and other nutrients would be things like Atlantic mackerel, coley, Pacific salmon, herring, anchovies, farmed oysters, Pacific wild sardines, and farmed raised trout. And when I say farm raised with some degree of trepidation, because not all farm fish are contaminated with methyl testosterone or other chemicals or antibiotics, so there's some that are doing a really good job with that.
All right, we are about out of time. I want to thank my guests, Biagio Pagano and Craig Volland. And we will, at some point, we talked about one issue. At some point, we'll do a show again on the impact of population on agriculture and vice versa. So thank you for joining us.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Now with our calendar of events provided by Natural E. Get a preview of upcoming world climate negotiations and why they are critical to ensuring a global reduction in greenhouse gas emissions at a Sierra Club presentation on the road through Paris. Sierra Clubs on both sides of the state line will join forces with other environmental groups to explore the importance of the 2015 UN Climate Change Conference that begins November 30th in Paris. The conference goal is to achieve, for the first time in more than 20 years of UN negotiations, a binding and universal agreement on climate change from every nation. The Road Through Paris event will address why the negotiations are critical, how the climate crisis threatens the next generation, and meaningful steps that each person can take to make a difference. The event begins at 6:30 on Tuesday, that's tomorrow, October 20th, at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center at 4750 Troost in Kansas City, Missouri. It will be held until 8:30. For more information, call 913-299-4474. That's 913-299-4474. Or visit the Kansas Sierra Club Facebook page. October 22nd from 5 to 8 p.m., the Harvest Happy Hour will be held to celebrate and raise funds for After the Harvest, a Kansas City nonprofit organization that provides fresh produce that would otherwise be wasted, provides this food to food banks and agencies feeding hungry people. The event will include complimentary admission, hors d'oeuvres, etc. Donations will be accepted and a silent auction will be held. The event will be from 5 to 8 p.m. on Thursday at Grace and Holy Trinity's Founders Hall, which is at 415 West 13th Street in Kansas City, Missouri. And more information at aftertheharvest.org. October 24th, that's Saturday, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., the City of Lawrence Solid Waste Division is hosting an electronic recycling event. Items accepted for recycling at the event include televisions, video and audio equipment, computers, printers, copiers, scanners, fax machines, microwaves, and other small appliances, cell phones, and other handheld devices. There's a $20 recycling fee per CRT television 27 inches and under, and $40 for CRT televisions over 27 inches. There is no recycling fee for other electronic equipment. Fees may be paid by cash or check. Items not accepted at this event include large appliances and household hazardous waste such as paint, pesticides, compressed gas cylinders, and fluorescent light bulbs. Electronic recycling will be provided by the Midwest Recycling Center. Again, that's from 9 to 1 on Saturday, October 24th, at the KU Park and Ride East parking lot on Clinton Parkway and Crestline Drive in Lawrence, Kansas, rain or shine. And that about does it for our program tonight. Thanks to Craig and Biagio and Craig for another fine program. And do stay tuned next week for a look at faith and the environment right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Obama does an about-face on Arctic drilling. That and other stories for the week ending October 18th, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
There was a dramatic turn of events in parts of the Arctic last week, as oil companies will no longer be allowed to drill in U.S. waters off of Alaska, at least temporarily.
Earlier this year, the Obama administration approved new drilling permits in the Arctic for Shell Oil. Environmental activists tried to stop those plans by surrounding oil rigs with kayaks and hanging from bridges. Despite those efforts, Shell got its rig to the Alaskan Arctic.
But now things have suddenly changed. Just a few weeks ago, Shell announced it was pulling out of the Arctic. And last Friday, the Obama administration announced that oil companies will not be allowed to bid on the right to drill in Alaskan waters, at least until 2017.
The administration said it wasn't going forward with the Arctic leases because of low interest in drilling there and low oil prices. The cancellations weren't based upon the difficulty of drilling in the remote region or about the significant environmental disasters that could occur.
The temporary halt leaves open the possibility that a new administration could reverse the ban.
Soon, world leaders will be gathering in Paris to address climate change, and it now looks as though the latest science is telling them that they might have a bigger problem to face than was previously thought.
Recently, there were important reports about methane being released into the atmosphere. Much of it comes from near the North Pole.
In Russia, Greenland, Canada, and Alaska, there's a lot of organic material that's been accumulating over thousands of years. As global warming occurs, the permafrost on top of that organic material melts and decomposes, releasing carbon into the atmosphere.
In addition to the carbon dioxide, there's great concern over the methane released by the melting permafrost because it traps much more heat in the atmosphere.
The melting permafrost in the Arctic could lead to a global temperature rise of nearly 1/2 of a degree Celsius. Efforts underway to keep warming to within 2 degrees Celsius may become much harder as the permafrost releases carbon.
And in yet another study released this month, scientists at the University of Washington have found that releases of methane from the ocean may be occurring due to water temperature rise.
About 168 methane plumes have been detected off the coast of Washington and Oregon in recent years.
It's possible that giant plumes of the gas are unlocked from where they have been frozen for thousands of years deep below the surface.
Scientists are concerned that even if the gas doesn't make it to the surface and into the atmosphere, it may cause greater acidification of the waters, harming marine life.
For the past decade, a mysterious illness has swept through the sugarcane fields of Central America.
More than 20,000 farm workers have died, and on one island in Nicaragua, the number of husbands lost is so high, the area has been nicknamed the Island of Widows.
No one knew the cause of the disease that attacks the victims' kidneys and prevents them from eliminating waste and fluids. Many suspected pesticides, toxins, or heavy metals.
But no one said climate change. That is, until Richard Johnson, a kidney specialist at the University of Colorado, got involved.
About 4 years ago, when Johnson first heard about the deaths in Central America, he wondered if chronic dehydration might be a factor. Laboring in the sugarcane fields means toiling in extreme heat for hours and often without access to fresh water.
He and his team conducted research in Nicaragua and El Salvador and found that the laborers suffered serious dehydration on a daily basis. Temperatures have been rising there since 1980, as have the number of extreme hot days.
In a paper published this month, Johnson noted that laborers had excess uric acid levels in their blood that's associated with dehydration. Ironically, the field workers would consume sugary soft drinks that would only exacerbate the problem. Fructose in soft drinks has been associated with developing kidney stones.
Johnson's study follows other research last year that suggested a link between kidney ailments and climate change. In a study of five major cities, it showed that as temperatures rose, so did the incidence of kidney stones.
In other climate news, it seems the Utah State School Board thinks sixth graders aren't quite ready to discuss things like climate change.
Instead, according to the Salt Lake Tribune, proposed new science standards will teach Utah youngsters, quote, how the greenhouse effect maintains Earth's energy balance and a relatively constant temperature.
Science specialist April Mitchell said that she was concerned that it would create a misconception for students that our temperature isn't changing.
Mitchell, who works with elementary students of all ages, said students are hungry for information, adding that as children as young as fourth graders ask about weather and climate change because they hear about it. It's in the news, and they also notice that it's not snowing in the winter.
Ricky Scott, a science specialist with the State Office of Education, denies the proposed changes are political, but rather to give students incremental information. In the eighth grade, students are taught about global warming.
In other science education news, Alabama has updated its science standards for K-12 education to require, for the first time, that students be taught about climate change and human contributions to a warming Earth.
Those new standards were approved unanimously by the state's GOP-controlled State Board of Education and made in recognition of the fact that colleges and universities will expect high school graduates to understand global climate change.
Finally this week, care about oceans and want to do your part to keep them clean? You're in luck. A husband and wife team of engineers from the University of California have created the first eco beachwear made of material that can absorb up to 25 times its own weight in pollutants.
Originally interested in coming up with a way to clean up ocean oil spills, the pair debuted their bikini that's padded with a sucrose-based material that repels water but sucks up harmful contaminants.
They said the material can also be made for swimming caps and wetsuits.
Our first thought, a stroke of genius.
It was an itsy-bitsy.
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.